When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, film spotters, Ridley Scott's Alien is celebrating its 45th anniversary this year with a re-release in theaters. We revisited Alien, Josh, upon its 40th anniversary back in 2019. We were reminded of something. It's really good.
It's so good. And yeah. And one of those movies, even though it's 45 years old, looks like it was made yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, like if they weren't allowed to use special effects, computer-generated special effects, and just focused on the practical, this movie is so real, puts you exactly in its imagined time and place. And it's also one of those you could rewatch countless times and never get sick of. It's got to be on my list of favorite movies to rewatch. And it turns out to talk about again and again. So from May 2019, here is that Alien Sacred Cow review.
The hell's about that box?
Dallas?
You're gonna have to hold your position for a minute. I've lost the signal.
What? You sure?
Look around. Are you sure that it's not there? I mean, it's gotta be around there somewhere.
Check that out, Lambert. You may be getting interference.
Dallas, are you sure there is no sign of it? I mean, it is there. It's gotta be around there.
Dallas?
All right.
Am I Claire Lambert? I want to get the hell out of here.
There's a single image from 1979's Alien that serves as the perfect visual metaphor for the entire movie, Adam. At the point I'm thinking of, the title creature is trapped in the air ducts of the Nostromo, the commercial towing vessel where most of the movie is set. Dallas, the ship's captain, played by Tom Skerritt, crawls in after it, hoping to finish it off with a flamethrower. The image I'm thinking of is the hatch to the air duct, which closes behind him in the shape of a metallic spiral, so that our circular view of him gets smaller and smaller until it shuts completely and he effectively disappears. This, in essence, is what Alien does to us. It constricts and constricts in terms of narrative and use of screen space until we're face-to-face with a monster. Now, the first time I saw Alien, this left me breathless. But how does it work on a second or perhaps a third or fourth viewing? Taking another look for this Sacred Cow review of the sci-fi classic, Adam, did familiarity with the movie's narrative and technique lessen the intensity of the experience, or did your appreciation for the film only grow, like a cute little xenomorph freshly exploded from the chest of its human carrier?
Yeah, I'll go that way.
Okay,
it was
good.
Definitely the latter. I think my appreciation for the movie did grow, and you're absolutely right in terms of that moment being a really good one where you're just keenly aware, too, that he is probably not coming back. There's just something really dreadful about when that hatch closes and he is trapped in that air duct.
It's been the trend.
Yeah, it absolutely has. And that sense of claustrophobia, you're right, is a key part of this film, really from the very beginning. And I want to go back to the very beginning of the movie because it has not only a great opening, it has a great opening credit sequence, Josh, right? Where we see the letters,
yes,
Alien spelled out as...
So slowly.
Yeah, so slowly, just coming to life, forming before us, just as the camera is panning and we're seeing this X-moon or whatever that the xenomorph comes from. These letters revealing themselves that way really does set up the entire movie, because this is a film that is going to take its time revealing to you ultimately what kind of film it is, and of course as well, which we'll talk about, who the hero of the movie is. And after we get done with that opening credit sequence, we get a shot that feels like it was lifted right out of the beginning of Star Wars, right? And this movie, of course, following right in the wake of Star Wars, any film that is certainly set in space, a sci-fi movie like this, is going to have to reckon with that in some way. And so we get that shot, that famous shot, from the underbelly of this large cargo ship as it goes by. And audiences very familiar, as almost anyone would have been at this time with Star Wars, may have felt like, oh, maybe we're in for another movie like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, what Ridley Scott, I think, whether it was conscious or not, it's a nice little subversion of your expectations, because everything that follows ultimately shows you that this is not going to be Star Wars at all. It's not going to be fantasy. It's not really even going to be spectacle. And from there, we then get the camera as it moves, that long shot of the camera roaming through the corridors of the Nostromo. And I actually watched this opening sequence just three or four times on Blu-ray after I watched the film in its entirety again, just because I enjoy watching the opening so much. I love the way the camera almost seems like a probe that has been sent to this ship to capture footage from the site of a disaster, maybe. It's as if it's already an abandoned ship, that it's haunted, that something has gone horribly wrong. And so it immediately piques our curiosity. There's this inherent sense of mystery, and then ultimately a sense of discovery. You're looking for whatever is going to be around every corner. And those little touches, the rustling of papers as the camera goes by, or on the table at one point, there are these two figurines that kind of bobble with motion. It's this sense that this place has been lived in, that people should be here, that it's been lived in.
Yeah, there's a human touch, even though we see no humans.
Exactly. And so it makes you wonder, is this place inhabited by ghosts? There's just something off about it. And of course, as you move through those corridors too, it's not like Star Wars. It's not like 2001, the vision Kubrick gave us, where the corridors aren't sleek. The spaceship doesn't feel really clean and maybe futuristic as we have come to envision it. It feels used, right? It feels not only rustic, but there's actual rust on the metal that makes up these corridors. And the more I watched it, the more I realized just how long and seemingly endless the corridors felt, but they are really tight. Again, going back to Star Wars or 2001, where Darth Vader steps on the ship and it feels like you have these vast spaces. There's a certain vastness to the length of it, which actually just makes it feel even more imposing and heightens that sense of dread, because you just have no idea what is out there. But when they're in those spaces, they are really confined by that space. And even when we finally meet the characters, and I love the fact that we're introduced to them over a dinner scene and mm-hmm. it casually throws us in. Even there, I noticed how often, and throughout the rest of the film, you see this too, how often we see these characters in close up. There really isn't a sense of them ever pinned against this vast landscape the way Ridley Scott does, I think, to really good effect, actually, in Prometheus. But here, he's going for something completely different.
There's always equipment, like, hanging over them. It's
yeah.
It's like a submarine, really, is the feeling that you get.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that I think Star Wars shares with this the lived-in feel, though. I mean, there are the ship you're mentioning in the very beginning of Star
yeah,
Wars has that clean look, not the Empire, but a lot of the other places we go and ships we see have this same lived-in feel. So I do like that. And I think also, I'm sure we'll get to this at some point, but what Alien shares in common with Star Wars is just fantastic creature design.
Mm-hmm.
It shows you how important it is to do that well. I'm glad you started with that opening, because one of the triumphs of this film is also its production design. And that's what really stood out to me this time. I don't know. I guess maybe I'm just instinctually a narrative guy. When I see films for the first time, I clue into the story.
Yeah.
And I'll notice things about production design. But often it's not until I go back and can let the story run around in the back of my head and look at more of the details that I'll see some of these things. And man, what you're talking about in the opening is so crucial. We should probably say that Michael Seymour was the production designer here. He was nominated for an Oscar. But that's, you know, the spiral hatch I talked about has everything to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an element of production design. There is that 2001-like communication center where they talk to Mother, the AI program running mm-hmm. the ship. That's so different from the rest of it, right? It's white. It has the little bulbs of light all over it. And
mm-hmm.
I love that contrast.
And the tiny little screens.
Yep, yep. And that sequence when they wake up from their hypersleep chambers or whatever they are, it adds to what you were talking about in this sense of emptiness in the ship and who works here, who's been here. And when those oblong egg-like contraptions open,
very egg-like,
what it does is it makes the humans seem like the aliens, like they're emerging. And it's just another early way we're put off center
mm-hmm.
in this film to unsettle us. And okay, what are these shapes coming out? Well, that looks human. And it's not until really they all start coming out of their sleep and fall into their more recognizably human activities like sharing a meal that we start to feel a little bit comfortable, like, okay, we've got our bearings now. And of course, after that, things just go crazy.
Exactly. And you're right about that sequence where they emerge, and John Hurt is the first character we see emerge. He plays Kane, who of course is going to famously meet a very tragic end later in the film. But that's another one that I rewound and watched over and over again because it almost catches you off guard. When you first see the camera, again, roaming the corridors, it stops on the door opens, and it's dark inside, and you're trying to make out a visual of what's inside there. And I had something completely different in my head from what then ultimately emerged in the light, which is these pods. And then you get this kind of quick dissolve as it actually changes the camera angle, because when it's coming into the room, it's not on John Hurt, I don't believe. But then all of a sudden, it is on John Hurt. So we moved the camera angle with this dissolve. And as he emerges, you're right, it adds to the sense, as you said, of something being alien with them. And as we get to that sequence, that's just another one of those little touches that Ridley Scott and the screenwriter Dan O'Bannon here gets so right, is we meet them as characters and we meet them as an ensemble in that dinner scene. We ultimately learn all the basics of their character, as we're going to see play out over the course of the film, through that conversation and in their interactions with each other. And I love that they give us that moment in a way that makes it about that ensemble. It makes it about them as characters. It's not about plot. It's not about setting up the story at all, but it is about giving us that background ultimately to who they are.
Still with us, Brett?
Clay.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel yes. Dead.
Anybody ever tell you you look dead, man? Oh, yeah, right. Now, I just forgot something, man. Before we dock, I think we ought to discuss the bonus situation.
Right.
Brett and
right.
I, we think we ought to... We deserve full shares, right,
right,
baby?
You see, Mr. Park and I feel that the bonus situation has never been on an equitable level.
Well, you get what you contracted for like everybody else.
Yes, but everybody else gets more than us.
Oh, the mother wants to talk to you.
Yeah, and we instantly understand the dynamic among all of them. You have Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton as sort of the grunts who work down below, and they're arguing about getting more pay, their mm-hmm. share. There's a class system at work
sure.
that is part of the more thematic interests in the movie, and it's so elegantly laid out how that structure is in place and where the tension points are. And of course, that comes into play later at crucial moments when rank is pulled or not pulled.
Yeah.
And that all adds to the tension and the suspense as well.
It does, definitely. And let's talk a little bit about its themes or what the movie is about. I don't know how much that really did factor into your viewing or your pleasure viewing this film, but we've already mentioned 2001, or I have a few times, and we talked about Star Wars. It's hard not to watch this film and think about those movies. And of course, think about all the films that have followed Alien, some within its own franchise, that are so beholden and owe so much to this film because we've seen so many elements that were done first here and really probably done best in Ridley Scott's film. But of course, at its core, if you're a fan of John Carpenter's The Thing, I believe from 1982, you'll think, boy, these films are awfully similar. And of course, that film followed this movie a few years later. But the original, the John Carpenter film, is based on the Howard Hawks film, The Thing from Another World from 1955. So it's the same basic storyline of an isolated group that comes upon mm-hmm. an alien creature that is determined to survive. That's all its objective really is. And it's going to do it by taking out these characters one at a time. Each movie even has a similar character that gets it in the form of the Kurt Russell character in the Carpenter version. And of course, Sigourney Weaver here is Ripley. But maybe because 2001 was a movie I just recently saw at the Music Box at the 70mm Film Festival, that it was so much in my mind. But one little adjustment that I saw this film make from 2001, setting up nicely Aliens. And of course, Aliens is in my head as well. We know sure. the sequel and what James Cameron does with the material. Is this movie is one where it's not about the machine or technology being ultimately responsible for the downfall of these characters. There's no doubt that Ash, played wonderfully by the great British actor Ian Holm, is certainly on some level a villain. I'm not denying that. And you can understand her distrust, Ripley, her distrust for any non-human crew member that we see play out in the movie Aliens. But ultimately, he's just following orders, right? Even Mother, the master computer here, is just following orders. And I mentioned those tiny little screens. There's something actually in the way I think Ridley Scott tries to downplay the all-powerful technology, because unlike the menacing red dot that seems all-powerful in HAL, this is just this tiny little screen that just gives us the little green data.
Yeah, it's a tool of others.
That's it. It's exactly right. And Mother is programmed, ultimately, by the corporation, just like Ash was. So, not to belabor it, but even in 2001, of course, there is a group of people who have told HAL what the mission is and have decided to leave the crew in the dark. But I think there's more of a sense of the people responsible being genuinely curious about the monolith and what's going on by Jupiter. It's not so much about trying to exploit anything for capitalistic or military gains.
And there's the question of if HAL has evolved in that film.
No, you're absolutely right. And of course, there's also a question of whether or not the fact that they program him to keep a secret is in fact what kind of undoes him. So Mother is just doing what Mother has been programmed to do. Ash is just doing what Ash has been programmed to do. So it's not as blatantly satirical or as anti-corporate as Aliens is. We don't have a Burke character like Paul Reiser here that you just really hate. You come to feel that way a little bit about Ash, certainly. But the movie seems to be really just setting up. In retrospect, you can look at it in 1979 and see it as a film that seemed to presage in some way the me decade of the 80s without hitting you over the head with it. Aliens hits you over the head with it, and I think does it in a good way. I love that film, too. But this is a movie that's just subtly kind of setting that up. And really, besides the anti-corporate notion here to the film, the tale at its core is as old as time. It's about hubris, right? It's about man's desire and ultimate futility at its inability to control nature. That really is what is at the core of this movie. And I think that's even why we feel a little bit of, maybe sympathy is the wrong word, as we learn more about Ash. But there's a sense of, before we really know that he's complicit in not caring about the downfall of the other crew members, we see him as potentially a man of science. And we understand that what he's doing may have a purpose and may have a good purpose.
Did you want something?
Yes, I had a little talk. How's Kane?
He's holding, no changes.
And, our guest?
Well, as I said, I'm still collating, actually, but, I have confirmed that he's got an outer layer of protein polysaccharides. He has a funny habit of shedding his cells and replacing them with polarized silicon, which gives him a prolonged resistance to adverse environmental conditions. Is that enough?
Holm is so good. He's instantly creepy throughout. And I got to say, I never felt any sympathy for him. The most terrifying scene in this movie, and I remember when I saw this when I was young, and even still strikes me today, is his, I don't know if you can say death, but his bludgeoning and his refusal to die and the way they prolong his so-called life. I mean, there's just something so eerie about that. But this is what I love about Holm's performance, is how he's always trying to balance, this Ash's impulse is to be logical and rational, to do whatever needs to be done to complete this mission he's been given. But he has to mask that under this veneer of human emotion.
Right.
So, and Holm is, the moment where he does this perfectly is when the other crew members, the quarantine debate, they're trying to get in and Ripley doesn't want to let them in. Mm-hmm. And Holm wants to let them in because he wants the creature in, but he masks that under human compassion by saying, well, they're my crewmates. Of course, I couldn't help but let them in. And just the levels of duplicity there are also very creepy. So yeah, you're right. It touches very lightly on, I think there are two things here that if you want to look for theme or meaning, it is absolutely a capital satire to some degree. Mm-hmm. And also it is something of a feminist statement, very lightly handled in the fact that Sigourney Weaver's Ripley is going to be the one who really, we get the sense, should have been in charge all along in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. ends up being in charge and has to solve things by meeting this alien, essentially, not fleeing, not outsmarting it or anything like that, but meeting it face to face and conquering it. I think both of those things, as you said, are brought to full flourish more in Aliens by James Cameron. Both of those elements, whether or not we were thinking about maybe trying to fit in Aliens too, but whether or not that makes Aliens the better film, I don't know. I'd have to take another look to say. But I really like how streamlined and delicately minimalist that Alien handles those two things while letting them be there and letting us mull over them. But really what it does, I want to get back to the creature design and talk about this a little bit because it's just, it's just so iconic. And it, you wonder, well, why is that? How many creatures have we seen at the movies? And this shows you the brilliance of being able to do something different, because in Batman v Superman, they roll out another one at the end of these space troll things that we've seen in how many movies? I mean, Alison Wilmore of Film Spotting SVU tweeted out something when that movie came out. I think she said, who wore it better? And it was like the space troll from Batman v Superman, the Lord of the Rings troll, which that came to mind right away. And then one other one, I think, from another recent superhero movie. And they all looked exactly the same.
Right.
Alien came up with something with Giger's design and working with the special effects team. They all did win an Oscar for their work. And I think there are a few key reasons why this does stick with us. And one of them is just that it's rooted in biology. They spend so much time on this thing's biology. And that, because we can recognize that and we can understand that, even though it's alien, it makes it so much scarier. I mean, my daughter is in fourth grade now. She's going through an intense animal phase, exploration phase. So she was telling me the other day about, and she'll be mortified that I don't get this right, but I believe it's a wasp or something that will land on another bug, lay its eggs, and when they hatch, they will have that other bug to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they grow, right? That's horrible. And it's happening right around us. So something like Alien transplants that everyday occurrence to this alien world, makes it happen to humans in the way they trace this biology and these parasitic functions. And to me, it's just rooting it in some level of reality that makes it that much more terrifying. And they get all the details right. Think about how goopy, you know, and how tactile this movie is when it comes to the alien. You've got that alien blood that's like acid, you know? You've got Hertz blood after the chest explosion thing is just awful for the room.
Right.
Ridiculous amount of blood. Ashes, quote unquote, blood, that kind of
milky,
creamy milk. Oh, that's terrifying. And then, of course, we have whatever is coming dripping out of the alien's mouth. So we're just drenched in all of this stuff that we can feel. We can feel it coming through the screen, and it's just it's just such a goopy horror experience, this movie.
Yeah, it is. And actually, while I was watching it, it made me think about a complaint you had about a film from the 70s that's a masterpiece, which is The Exorcist, which has some similarly sexual bodily functions and all sorts of other fluids that we see play out and horrifying sequences. And you were very turned off by those.
Didn't buy
in
a
the
minute
Exorcist.
Of those.
But here, something like the chest bursting scene seems very similar to me in some ways, and for me, just as effective.
I think the reason I didn't buy any of those is because they seemed, even though they were taking place on Earth with an actual human, they seemed less realistic, if that makes any sense. Once you're rooting what's going on here, once we've walked ourselves through the process from egg to hatching to, again, all these recognizable biological functions, that makes it more real to me than what was going on in The Exorcist.
Well, how aware of you? I mean, you mentioned biology, but let's talk specifically about sex. How much were you aware as you watched it about the phallic nature of the alien that also seems to be mixed with a very feminine aspect to it? And the fact that, I mean, O'Bannon himself, the guy who wrote the original screenplay for this film, is pretty explicit in some of his interviews about this movie, saying that he was really trying to make every male in the audience feel queasy, that he was trying to give you almost the most horrific version of a birth scene. Huh. And that's what it is in the form of John Hurt. And even in the form of the face hugger that first attaches itself to John Hurt, this is basically, as he put it, an oral rape. He is trying to give men the feeling of watching a horror film that women have felt watching horror films for decades.
Yeah, I know that. I know that thesis is out there, and that it was, you know, partly intentional, as you say, but I got to say, I'd never really registered to me that way. And again, it goes, maybe it simply goes back to myself being as a kid, like into animals to the degree of watching so many nature shows that that's just stuff of Earth to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all stuff that animals do. And certainly it has that metaphorical value too. But to me, it was more a situation of, okay, what if you were somewhere in space and these sort of processes that we avoid as civilized humans began to happen to us?
Yeah.
And that was frightening enough for me.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And I think going back to Weaver a little bit, and one of the real delights of this film being that the movie really takes its time and is quite deliberate in how it reveals itself, what kind of movie it really is. And that comes through in the way that we don't really know who the protagonist is. We don't really know who our hero or our heroine is going to be. And this movie launched Weaver's career. And we've talked about her a little bit when we've talked about Aliens. I know it's made a top five or two of mine over the years. But really with her, what she exudes is this sense of real pragmatism, right? It's not like she's a super badass. She becomes more of a badass as the films go on. Yeah, by necessity. But it's just her pragmatism that we respect the most. And I think what really comes through in this, you know, going back to the line about how I said I had some sympathy for Ian Holm, what I really meant was just the fact that if you do see him early on as a pure scientist, I mean, you've discovered an alien creature out there in the universe. Of course, you're going to be curious and actually want to figure out what it is as opposed to just destroying.
Sure. And he is serious about his work and we're as curious. So I guess you want to follow him along for those reasons.
Right. But unlike that creature, which as Ash describes it in a way that you could describe certainly a lot of corporations that we saw on screen in the 1970s in this era kind of disillusionment, he describes it as the perfect organism. I admire its purity, its sense of survival, unclouded by conscience, remorse, or delusions of morality. Ash isn't describing a biological creature at all. He's describing an entity, an unfeeling entity whose only goal is to continue to exist and to flourish, right? And so you can see how that metaphor, of course, harkens back to the capitalism a little bit. But what makes Ripley so great is that she exhibits, instead of the hubris that really the corporation exudes, she has respect for that creature and the potential threat of that creature and the unknown of nature in general. But she also, of course, has respect for human life. The whole reason she won't let that thing on board the ship is because she recognizes that it could be a threat and it could be a threat to everyone on board. Of course, Ash and the company, they don't have either of those traits, unfortunately. But the little bit of misdirection, again, going back to the Star Wars bit maybe, and the fact that it'd be very easy to think that Tom Skerritt as the captain is maybe going to be the hero of this movie, and they just keep getting picked off one by one until we realize, okay, actually the person who's made the most sense the whole time, she's really the hero of this story. Now, what's interesting, thinking about her as a feminist icon, if you will, I wonder, though, about the fact, Josh, looking back, and I don't think this is really a knock on the film, but I just think it's worth discussing. It is interesting that when we see her interacting with Veronica Cartwright, Lambert, who is perhaps a bit more of a stereotypical woman in an action movie, right? She's chain smoking and she's very afraid and she's hysterical. And in the point where the alien is coming down on her, she just cowers and
she freezes.
Doesn't do anything. Whereas
the opposite,
like Ripley,
of Ripley.
Yeah, Ripley is defined by her action. She's always acting, right? They're bickering with each other the first time we see them really interact with each other when they're doing their jobs. And then in a key scene where Ripley, as the senior officer, goes to Ash, and this is the scene you were referring to where he couches everything as if he really cared about human life. Well, what did you want me to do? I had to let them on board the ship. Kane might die. She points out to him that he didn't act within the manual. He didn't do what he was supposed to do. He didn't act like a science officer who should have known that they needed to stay in quarantine. And when he says, I care about doing my job just as much as you do, and you need to let me do my job, she just turns and walks away. The movie really does just have her in that moment. I don't know what she should have done instead, but she doesn't have any response to that. And she certainly doesn't put Ash in his place. She does consistently let Ash undermine her.
Yeah, I think that didn't bother me because she doesn't quite yet have the authority over him that she might need to do anything because Dallas is still around and he's the captain at this point, as long as he is around. I actually, you know, that was the scene for me where I felt like we would swing over her way, because it would take guts even to go ahead and challenge him about that. I think the alternative would have been to just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
But no, she shows here that just because they're equals in terms of colleagues, just because maybe this would come into play, she's a woman, she's not going to drop it. She's going to pursue it with him. She's going to go tell him, hey, you did it. You did it against my command. And actually, maybe she is his superior at that point. But anyways, in this experience of the film, it felt to me like that was her stepping out. That was one of the moments where she did try to take charge mm-hmm. by holding to the quarantine. And even though that didn't work, she still stepped out and was like, hey, this was out of line.
For sure.
And at least my sympathies go with her at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I did want to ask you about, and I've debated whether or not I should bring this up only because I potentially look A, foolish for not getting it, or B, foolish for not spending more time researching it and finding an answer because it's probably out there. But did the chronology of the corporation slash mother slash Ash, did the chronology of their understanding of what the creature is or what their desires for the creature, the alien, were, was that clear to you? Because the reason I'm asking is, as you watch the movie play out without knowing that there's anything nefarious going on,
right,
you just assume that he is being a man of science. Ash is saying, I want that organism on board this ship.
Yeah.
You don't know why or what he's going to do with it or that anyone else cares about it. You just think he wants it. And like I said, you can kind of understand that. But the notion is almost there's this tremendous irony in the fact that somebody set up a distress signal that was actually a warning, and the warning signal is the very thing that drew them to the planet, right? Instead of it doing its job and functioning as a signal that would scare people away, it actually drew the people there. Okay, but as you get through the film, it becomes clearer from the discussions with Mother and what Ash says to Ripley in that confrontation that the notion is Ash was put on this ship all along. The
right.
mission of this ship from the very beginning was to find that very beacon and to discover it and to take it back. So I just wanted to be clear on that. That is how we see it, that from the very beginning, there was never any accident them stumbling across this on LV-426. Am I right?
I don't know about that. I think you're right in that wasn't Ash a last-minute replacement?
Right.
Yes. So I think that
And they suggest he was because they knew.
Right. So, but, you know, for me, it didn't bother me or trip me up for a couple of reasons. I mean, they may have put him on there because they somehow found out that there was the possibility of this mm-hmm. and this particular crew was going to be nearby. Maybe it was the closest vessel nearby.
Yeah.
So that did bother me. And also, once communications are back up, you know, I was just assuming that there were other communications going to Ash by some way, through Mother, something like that.
No, I did as well. In fact, I thought there was a scene maybe where Ash was in the computer room with Mother by himself, and I went back and scanned through it, and that doesn't exist. Though I love that little bit of misdirection again where Ripley's in there, and then Ash in that shot of all of a sudden right next to her.
Yes.
And that is pretty scary. But it's not something that really bothered me so much as it's interesting that if we buy the idea that the corporation knew all along that this organism somehow existed out there
mm-hmm.
and had an objective to bring it back, and that's really why they put these people on this ship, it, of course, opens that larger question of, well, how did they know it was out there? And maybe this is some of the stuff Ridley Scott was attempting to answer in Prometheus, which I don't remember enough about it.
You're getting a headache territory
now. Is that it did occur to me that then something that is fundamental to the story is not explained at all. They really do leave it out there just for you to think about and I guess ponder, how did they know? How did they ever get information back about this life force? It was something anyway that did stick in my mind as I watched the movie.
One thing I wanted to get to before we wrap up,
I hope you're going to say Jerry Goldsmith.
Well, we can talk about that, and we probably should. I was going to talk about the performances a little bit, and you touched on this in the beginning when you mentioned the close-ups, because so many of the key moments here are in close-up. They're partly in dialogue to establish that dynamic among the crew, but once that's set in place, we get a lot of the fear and the wonderment
mm-hmm.
and the terror, really, at some point by close-ups. And I think Weaver is especially good at this. Home, we talked about a little bit. And even Skerritt, too. And just formally, what I like that Scott does with these close-ups is there's an early rhythm to the movie where we'll get one of those really tight. It's all face. And then the very next shot, after a quick cut, is some expanse, some wide vast expanse. Skerritt looking at the X-Moon itself. You know, we'll see his face, and then we get this spectacular planetary vista. And then later on, there's the one of John Hurt in his space helmet when they're on the planet. And he's, you know, fearful there. And then the next one is that cavernous egg-hatching lair.
Yep.
So those two come right after each other. And just going back to this sense of constriction that I was talking about at the beginning, I noticed this time that that rhythm slows down as the movie goes on and we get less of the cutaway shots to expanse and more close-ups and more interiors. And eventually, that's all we're left with. So we it's like the movie's tightened itself, tightened the actual space around us by the end, and we're left with more of those close-ups that are
We never get outside the ship.
We don't. I think the last one we get outside is when she's in the escape shuttle. There's one of the, there's one of those when she's about to launch, but at that point, it's kind of a false relief,
right?
Because we're not really at the end.
No. And Jerry Goldsmith, I wanted to bring him up because we've talked about really all the key players in this except for the composer. And I'm notoriously bad at describing why I like scores, but I really like this score. I mean, everything that we've talked about that's effective about this film in terms of this creeping sense of dread and the isolation and the deliberateness and the subtlety, those elements all do come through in the music.
I'd agree. It's that one of my first notes was, wow, hardly any score.
Right.
Like, I didn't remember it that way. But what it is that the score is in the exact right places.
Yeah.
And so
it's drawing attention to itself.
No, but I don't think you could call it like necessarily subtle.
No,
like when it's
not,
there, it's doing its work.
It's not hiding.
No, but it's just doing its work at exactly the right moment.
Absolutely. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.